Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
What's up, fam?
Gentlemen, I have been doing a deep dive into the world of future of aviation.
Aviation?
I have found there are way more players trying to develop next generation aerial vehicles than I've realized. Now, we've certainly seen some of the ones that have basically a lot of what passes for flying cars and stuff is really just, you know, electric helicopters with like more rotors, you know, screw it. We're going to do 32 propellers.
I mean, to be honest, like the more propellers, the better, because there's only one thing I fear if I'm ever on a helicopter, and that's the one rotor going out.
Well, you know, in theory, they say that can auto rotor down. I don't know how well that really works.
The idea being it becomes like a whirligig or one of those C-pods, you know, you know what I'm talking about, where it's like sort of, you know, float down.
Yeah, like a lot of the helicopter accidents we hear about, tragically, like Kobe was like in a hit running into a hill. In Iran, bad weather, running into like a hill or like power lines and stuff. So they might auto rotor. I mean, not an aviation expert here, but I know that's the theory. But there are some of the systems they work on. You know, there's things that like you put in parachutes, other stuff. And I've been looking at some different ones that use alternate methods besides just using like plain old school rotors. Because there's different sort of air effects. There's one company, let me pull up because I'll show you. I don't know how far along they really are. They've actually, you know, done a test flight
While you're looking this up, quick shout out to a book that we talked about in the past, Where Is My Flying Car? The engineer who wrote that book was really obsessed with why not gyroplanes? And he, you know, he talks about the difference between, you know, precise vertical takeoff and landing versus the ability to stop on a dime and all of that stuff. If you're into all of that, but just now, and I'm hoping you've called it up there, Andrew, if I'm guessing right, I'm going to put my prediction in an envelope. I want to hear what you were leading towards.
Well, the gyrocopters are hugely dangerous. You still need runway. You still need takeoff. They don't solve a problem. They're not as precise. They're prone to wind. I mean, they're just, it's like whenever I hear, you know, that it's like, it reminds me of like Arthur C. Clarke advocating for hovercraft. And then he tried a hovercraft and realized.
And I'm certain that's the case, but it is always fun to, like, things I didn't know about a gyrocopter is that they did require a runway to take off, but they didn't require a runway to stop. Little stuff like that is interesting.
Yeah, they're cool. There's like one company that's making like, you know, experimental ones, but like it's one of the things where the, you know, when your founder of your company has like died testing your craft, not a good sign.
It's a bad look. So.
Yeah. And yeah, it's one of those things like they are certainly quirky and cool. And remember that was Little Nelly from the James Bond movie. I think it was You Only Live Twice, where they assemble the thing out of it. That's what that was. It was as a gyrocopter. But anyway, I just sent you a thing. So this is one company. I'll find another one. This is a company called Cyclotech. It's a European company. They're working on a system where basically imagine several blades are kind of like rotating in like a drum, like a cylinder. And, you know, and so sort of like you can have the pitch and whatever of a helicopter, but you don't have these huge blades sticking out. You have these sort of like kind of like turbine systems that are coming out. I think they have a test of their, so you can see that design. If you want to describe that to everybody.
To be honest, it's not entirely clear what it looks like right from the beginning. It kind of looks like, I want to think of like a dam's hydrology engine, the things that the turbines that spin, that create electricity, basically. Would that be in the ballpark?
Yeah. I mean, like imagine like, you know, drums that have like rotors, you know, that stick out on like, you know, at 4 points on there. So they're one. So I think that I mean, obviously going for aesthetics is not the way to choose a flying car.
Right.
But you don't get
to decide how cool Air wants to be at any moment.
Yeah. But you know, they claim that this thing provides, it's got a lower noise level than other systems. And, you know, that, and I would say, you know, certainly aesthetically, do they have the actual test footage there?
I am sure. I'll poke around on it. Yeah, there we go.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. So yeah. Now what we're seeing is, oh my goodness. Okay. So from the head-on view, I want you to picture looking at an agricultural combine, that is just happening to float in the air. It looks like you are the corn and it's about to gobble you up. However, from the side view, it looks like an upside down Formula One race car with
Blade Runner spinner
with sleds. That's incredible. How did you run across this?
I just started doing, you know, kind of a deep dive, and I'll show you another one. Another one is Jetoptera, which they've got a different approach where they've got a closed thing. But anyway, so like, imagine like 4 50-gallon drums, you know, or, you know, 600, whatever big large drums attached, you know, like where the wheels would be.
Yeah.
But with like turbines, you know, like blades. So the helicopter blade sort of like spins around in a circular pattern and it can adjust its pitch. And they also have ones in the center, which can move it side to side. They claim this can give it incredible precision. Their concept video, they show somebody like literally walking into their garage, getting into the thing. I hope you don't have any loose newspapers laying around your garage, because that's the thing, that the two things that get undersold of these things is, one, the noise, and two, the wind.
Well, and the noise was a big one. Even, you know, 10 years ago when we were reminiscing about the Mahler Sky Car, like they just couldn't get over the decibel limit to make it remotely approachable for you know, your home use.
Yeah, there was, you know, a problem with precision control, a lot of things.
Also investor funds.
Well, because they kept, you know, they kept promising this thing. So I'm going to send you the link to Jetoptera, Brian. That is, they have a different take on this, which is they're using a thing called, they call it fluid propulsion.
So fluid propulsion implies to me that this is going to be something closer to like the, I don't know, the jet ski Ironman setup or something where you're actually propulsing fluid, but that would have an amount.
No, what they mean is, I can see why. Yeah. They've been around since like 2017, Jetoptera. So what they're doing is basically, imagine the Dyson fan that's supposed to like have the turbine that makes the air pass over. It's like they call the Carnot effect, where basically you're pushing more air and creating that.
This is the fan that just looks like a circle, but somehow propels air.
Yeah. And I don't know how viable Jetoptera is right now or not.
You set this up while I'm getting it loaded.
So what they're working on is basically creating a central system that's got your turbines into it, whatever, and then it's blowing air through there. But I always worry when they pivot and start showing you like dramatically different stuff. Like now they're pivoting and showing us a ground effect vehicle, which
ground effect is, it takes a lot less, correct me if I'm wrong on this, it takes a lot less fuel and you don't have to be so fast as long as you just sort of ride just over water or something. Like you're almost doing a hydrofoil thing, but it's on a cushion of air. And as a result, it's efficient and like a hovercraft without blowing down. You're just riding the air currents of the bottommost pressure.
Yeah, I'm, you know, what they started off to say they wanted to do and what they're trying to do now has changed dramatically. And that always makes me kind of concerned. It's this, you know, kind of I remember it was Hyperloop one of the now defunct Hyperloop companies, you know, which none of which were Elon Musk's, by the way. I think that people made that mistake of assuming that. They originally said, oh, we're going to build Hyperloops. Then I went to their HQ and they had all these videos showing using them for offloading cargo on ships and stuff. And I'm like, your throughput problem there is your number of cranes, not how fast you move it from the offload side.
Yeah, that kind of seems like a solved problem.
Yeah.
It's called trucks.
Or more specifically, it sounds an awful lot like how I make my deposit at the bank or at the CVS pharmacy with pneumatic tubes. Just sort of suck from one place to the other.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't want to be dismissive.
I mean, unless you were going to do like insane tubes that would like go to regional nodes or something like that. If you were going to make crazy like Hyperloops, then maybe. But at that point, you're talking about way, way, way bigger projects than you probably would be able to get. You'd be taking more of a risk than just trying to solve traffic.
Yeah, I despite some of these cars, some of these ideas kind of not going anywhere at the moment, or some of them going defunct and stuff, I am kind of confident that, you know, famous last words, I think by the end of the decade, we're going to have, you know, human rated ones that you will be using in a city. That you'll feel comfortable, yeah. That can actually be used in some limited commercial use. And I think that we're going to get increased efficiencies from our motors. We're going to get increased efficiencies as far as the systems that work. I think that we're going to, the math checks out that you can build an efficient system to do this. The trouble is, how do you limit noise? And, you know, noise is sort of your biggest factor. But, you know, I had an argument with a guy who was a tech investor, who was like saying like, oh, he was like, you know, Hyperloops are dumb. All this tunnel's dumb. It's all going to be flying cars. I'm like, I don't know either one, but I know if you take all the traffic around us right now, all the car traffic, and you put it all in flying cars, the noise is going to be insane. And if you're, you know, we're sitting in like, you know, downtown, you know, like in Santa Monica or whatever in LA, I'm like, there are 60 cars around us right now. If imagine each one of them is as loud as 10 leaf blowers.
Can we play a hypothetical game? And I'm going to just say dumb stuff, but what if like right now I'm west of Austin, literally on the city limits. In the kind of rural area where most people have acreage, and when I hear a bang, it's 50-50 whether or not it's somebody practicing with a shotgun or playing with fireworks. Traffic noise is annoying because there's a road close to me, but when I get to the back of the acreage, I don't hear it very much at all. It's very, very peaceful. If we could imagine a kind of exciting launch system, and if we could also imagine, and I'm going to give the caveat of, I understand how chaotic the vectors are when it comes to tracking weather patterns, especially down to the second, or wind patterns or whatever. But if we could imagine a set of sensors so precise that we knew exactly where updrafts were happening and downdrafts and all that, would it be the craziest thing to imagine that we could end up with glider as being a fashionable way to get from point A to point B? Like, all you need is the energy to get up enough that you, and enough intelligent AI with enough precision measurements of actual weather conditions, you know, down to the foot. Hypothetically, if I wanted to get from here to there and robots were doing it, couldn't quite silently I just launch up to a few hundred feet and then let the robot take it from there and very dead silently get me to my destination on the other side of town?
I don't know. I think the problem is when you're talking about trying to navigate a dense cityscape, an environment like that, and also glider implies you're not worried about going sideways or running into a thing. You're going to have to be using power at some point because there's just not going to have like the perfect flight path.
Sure. But let's much like sailboats have engines. Let's factor for that.
Yeah, but sailboats are in a wide open sea. When you start to navigate into port, that's when you use your motors, because a sailboat on the ocean has a wide forgiveness. You know, you have 10 minutes to correct your course, but once you start to get into harbor, you don't. And so that's why, like, even large oceans, like your big, you know, ocean freighters, they use smaller boats that are always powered to navigate them into port because they don't have the fine-tuned control. So I'd say that would be the challenge, is just that, like, you're going to have to make so many corrections using power to do that. But I mean, it's not, I don't want to say like, oh, it's a crazy idea, Brian, which I would be happy to do. But
let me reframe the pitch. Let's not make it a local commuter vehicle, but instead, we know in general that cities produce urban heat island effects that, you know, mm-hmm. and that hot air rises. We also know that, you know, part of the reason that carrion birds are able to just float so high up all day long is because they just ride the thermals up. And I've only ridden on a hang glider once, and that's the only time I ever intend to, now that I know how dangerous they are. But when I was driving out to Las Vegas, I saw, I don't know, about 200 miles from anywhere, just a guy sitting looking at his cell phone parked underneath his hang glider. And it was clear to me that he took off and he was able to find enough thermals to go very, very far away. And now he was going to wait 2.5 hours for his friend to drive out and pick him up and disable his rig. I wonder if AI and sensors could create essentially a highway of predictable thermal vents, thermal updrafts over certain cities and so on. And well, you could like not, you could be reading a book and have the robot do everything.
Yeah. I don't know. Again, that if you're going to use lighter than air, that's fine. The problem is like you use those things where you have the updrafts, and when you don't, you just don't use gliders. Like when we were using, like they used, the highest point of glider use was actually in World War II, when they would like literally tow planes behind other planes and do like tow gliders, which was like just insane. And so that's just the problem, is that like it's great where you have the thermals to do it, but where you don't, you don't. If your glider, even your best glider, like, you know, which falls at say 100 feet per foot, you're still going to go hit the ground because there's just not enough updrafts to keep you going.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering what would be possible if your pilot was at the precision, speed, information ubiquity of a artificially intelligent computer, then like maybe, you know, it'll say you have an 80% chance of making it by 6 o'clock. And then it's like, oh, I'm sorry. New weather data is here and you'll be staying the night at this midpoint. But don't worry, we'll launch again tomorrow. I don't know, that seems a little bit less insane than it did 5 years ago.
Yeah, but I'm saying is that you can't, if you don't have the updrafts, like if you're going across the plains, you just don't have the updrafts. They're just not, you're literally going to be trying to build, you know, the Rutan Voyager, you know, right, which is what you're going to want.
You are correct that if there's no updraft, then there is no updraft. However, we live in an age where, you know, like Justin and I right now are crossing our fingers that a hurricane will come and be a tropical storm and bring us lots of rain. If that precision, that up to the minute precision about knowing where the updrafts were and predictably, I don't know, it makes me think about like the way casinos, They don't need to know who's going to be the winners and losers. They just need to know that there'll be enough action.
Yeah, but I'm saying like you're going to have Florida. There's none. You're never going to have in Florida. You're never going to have that. You don't have gliding in Florida because you can do towed gliders, have an airplane take you up and do it. But like literally you're never going to navigate across because updrafts come from geographic locations, right?
Yeah.
Your updrafts are based upon mountains, whatever, that structure where the wind comes up and creates that. So that's the hard part, is there's some places like you just, I'm not saying it couldn't, could be jet stream paths, stuff like this. So,
well, and that's a good point. I guess for this hypothetical exercise, I'd have to consider certain areas, like you just wouldn't use that service, but for others,
it might be a novel way. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that they've in, you know, when they plot like, you know, the jet stream, that the effect that had on global trade and whatnot, from first oceans and actually, you know, airplanes too, the effect that has on it, I certainly think that lighter than air, you know, aircraft are near that's powered, like things like that. As to your point, as we get way better microclimate data and stuff like that, that makes dirigibles, that makes these things more useful tools. And I think that we're going to see, my prediction, the two most visible signs that we're going to approach is the future, you know, by the end of the decade, are going to be the prevalence of robotics and flying vehicles. And some of those flying vehicles might use more traditional things like you're pointing out that we sort of discounted because we didn't have the precision control. We didn't have the weather data. We didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah. Well, and I know we're deviating from the original question, but what you said just made me remember the hypothetical, the siren song of a solar powered glider that could just go all around the world based on solar power, and it just and smart flying.
And that was, you know, back when Google did Project Loon and they talked about what they wanted to do, aerospace engineers said, no, you can't do it. We tried. That's not going to work. And then Google brought in a layer of precision computation and whatnot to do it. And they pulled it off. They were able to do it. It wasn't economically viable, but they did technically. They showed, yes, you can, you know, get these balloons to go around the world to create this communications network. You could get these balloons to last longer, stay higher than could before. And I think that because people do get dogmatic. An area I think we're going to see a really cool thing is human powered flight. You know, I think the human powered flight records were probably set. Let's go look at the record by human powered flight. Like, when was the last time somebody set a record for that? But with newer materials and, you know, AI and doing stuff like this.
And I guess also like highly developed flywheels, where it's like you're not using the energy when you don't need it. You're able to kind of build it up.
The problem with that, that's a weight problem. Yeah. That's the thing.
Oh, I guess so. That's the whole way flywheels work. Yeah. Whoops.
Yeah. So let's see let's look for the record. The longest record single distance line was set by Daedalus 88 in 1988. It flew 71 miles from Herculaneum on the island of Crete to the island of Santorini.
Oh, wow. And they did it on danger mode over the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're probably like 10 feet off the ocean at most times. So as I say, they're only this. They did.
Wouldn't that be great to bring one of those craft to like one of those Red Bull? Everybody's an idiot, just running off with a mattress, trying to flap their arms, and then you just go.
How much do you think this airplane weighed?
Oh man, I would have to guess less than 100 pounds.
Justin.
I would say 75 pounds.
$1.
68 pounds.
Wow. Yeah, I had the way over.
I don't think it had any landing gear. I think they had to do a water landing too.
Well, yeah, but you're probably not going that fast either. You're probably not worried about.
Yeah, I mean.
You have nothing to worry about. You have no sharks to worry about. You have no embarrassment to worry about. You're just a cool guy pedaling a bike in the sky.
It was pedaled by Olympic cyclist Kanellis Kanellopoulos of Greece.
That's amazing. So, and he successfully landed it on purpose.
Yeah, I think they ended in water 7 meters from the Parisian beach. Okay. When increasingly gusty winds caused a torsional failure of the tail boom. Lacking control of the plane, then pitch nose up and another gust calls a failure of the main rudder. The pilot swam to shore.
Yeah.
But that's the thing that I think that we're going to see a lot of these kinds of records and stuff fall. Like I've shown you like the 3D printed stuff I've been playing with, your ability to build these materials, the cost dramatically lowering on that. So the more times you get to experiment, the more you get to do. And that's why I think that like a big pivot is going to be, there might be an optimal design for one of the flying car designs we looked at. The problem is every time they want to build a prototype, if it costs them $150,000 plus all the labor and everything else like that, that's a lot of money. And if you need to get through 20 generations of a thing to get there, you're going to run out of investor patience for there. But you know, you can sometimes get kind of pretty close. And then when you see these hard pivots, you realize, oh, this the math says yes, reality says no.
Speaking of which, I think we're coming up on a month since you impulse purchased your Bamboo. Can we get an update on how you like it?
Not before we remind everybody that patreon.com/weirdthings is where you need to go if you want to support this show. patreon.com/weirdthings. Now, yes, Brian, please indulge the heroin addict in conversations about heroin.
I've been using it like almost every day to print something. I also print stuff because I like to show people. Like I went, I went to a party with some of the people I used to work with at OpenAI, and you know, a lot of them kind of love geeky stuff like that. So I made like some finger choppers and stuff.
Oh, that's great! Like, can you demonstrate for the video watchers? Like finger choppers are amazing.
Ow! Oh, my finger's still there. So. This is a 3D printed finger chopper. If you just use one color, you can print it, all at once. I just use the two color mix for that. I make one that's black and white, one that's white and black. 3D printed finger chopper. I showed you this before, my switchblade.
Yep.
Went to the neighbor's house yesterday, gave them to their children so they could play. I had a fidget toy, which I eventually fidgeted too much. Did I show you these, Brian?
No. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the handcuffs.
You flash them, and they're fully functional. These are of the same variety of as police-issued
Well, they're not. Ones. There's no key, so these are, got the little trick thing. But you could very simply modify this to be a key handcuff. The goal is these are, trick-release handcuffs. I needed a Rubik's Cube stand, because, of course, so I've got my Rubik's Cube stand. So
How many of these did you grab designs online and just modify?
All of them. I haven't designed anything yet with this printer. Little trick box. Oh, I can't open it. Oh, I can't. Oh, sideways. Ooh. Yeah. It's been fun. I've been making I got so many pens on my desk. Let me take care of them. I got a pen holder and this holder. It's what's great about the Bamboo printer. For the four color spool, everything was $500. If you just want to do one color and just a smaller print bed, $200 all in is insane.
Is it the right? Let's say hypothetically, the summer was the lean time at the Brushwood family, and we knew that we had big conferences and big gigs coming up, but. Meanwhile, I got a passel of bored kids around. Would it be worth it to just bite the bullet and spend $500 and give all three of my girls something to go crazy about?
Yeah, heroin addict. Is heroin worth buying?
Well, guys.
Asking for a concerned citizen who's thinking about whether or not heroin's good for his kids.
I will say this.
The one thing is when you only get the one spool heroin, it's only $200.
But the four spool.
Can heroin do this? Between my $3,500 Apple Vision Pro, which I do not use, which I then printed a stand for with my 3D printer, so now I can stare at this thing that I do not use. I would say Bamboo Labs is having a sale on the Bamboo Lab A1 3D printer. If you get it with the filament, the four-color filament spool thing, it's $489.
Uh-oh.
It's $339 without that. But the four color spool, I highly recommend.
It's the finest. The finest, man. When it hits your bloodstream, bro, it just, it's like fireworks.
It's like, the spools come in many different colors. Mm. There's China white. There's black tar. There's, that's the extent of my heroin knowledge.
Just wait till you buy this spool, though. Dude, you're living in a zero spool life. You could be four spool tonight.
I will say this. I have been getting practical usage out of it, which I haven't in the pre path. I mean, I did, you know, at one point print hard to make some magic stuff. I wouldn't get into it and fully justify it, but I would say, like, you know, my 3D printed Apple Vision Pro holder, I would end up paying like $30 or $40 for something like that.
I will say this. So there is a currently inoperable 3D printer in my living room that I bought my wife for Christmas, and something got jammed. We had somebody fix it. It got jammed again. Like, and so it is that uncanny valley of there's not super easy ways to fix certain problems with 3D printers, and they are a little fussy. Everything I've heard from Maine on this, who has probably put the most time and effort into 3D printers that I know, is that this is user-friendly, reliable, and by way of both AI and design choices, cuts down on some of the worst or most common problems with 3D printers. So in terms of investing money, it does seem like a thing. I've thought about getting one for my wife, for whom we are about to spend a lot of time not leaving our house. So having things to do while we are not taking care of our newborn child will probably be at a high premium. And she loves 3D printing. So it has crossed my mind.
It has been the one 3D printer where I'll set it running, leave the house, and know that I'll come back. I'm going to have my print, you know, and it's fun because I sort of sit there because it's extremely reliable. And, you know, to the point of where I look at this 3D printer because, like I said, like right now it makes simple things really well. Things like, but it's like, you know, I wanted, my wife wanted another iPhone stand. So I made an iPhone stand. You know, we had a little iPhone stand. I needed stuff to put my pens and pencil. Like I could go buy, like, I don't know, let me go see what this is going to be. It's the first time that I've actually bought like a 3D printer and have thought like, you know what? I will probably, if I add up all the stupid stuff I'm going to buy on Amazon in the next year.
Can I double down on that? Because there's also like, I'm working with Ryer Appledorn on a number of art projects that will eventually be properly made and mass produced for scamstuff.com. But in the meantime, he, you know, is a whiz at 3D printing. And so, but he has to send them to me, and that's some amount of shipping stuff. And he could just download it to me and I could get it. Likewise, I spent, ended up being just under $8,000 to rehab an old well. And the old well on this property does not produce very much because it's dry and the water table is low. However, even at that level, when essentially the water is free, it's taken like, I don't know, 2 weeks, but the pool in the back that cost us $500 to fill with city water is now mostly full. And so at this point, it's like, okay, I only have to fill that pool, you know, 16 more times, and now I'm ahead. Here's a phrase I've never been able to say before. I think I could see the cost efficacy of buying this if it's as reliable as you present.
Yeah,
I hear heroin's really good.
Yeah, here we go. At a certain point, you start doing enough heroin, you're making money.
I will say this. If I tried to buy that holder online, it'd be like $25. And actually the one I have has a much less footprint than anything I saw on Amazon. I probably, of the stuff I've actually made that's useful, probably saved myself like $45-$50, which is not a lot right now. But when I look at this printer too, I think these things are only getting better and they're going to get cheaper and they're going to be able to do more complex stuff because at some point you might just drop, you know, might be able to do more compound mechanisms. You might put a little tiny Arduino in there or something. Like, I can see a thing in the not too distant future. One, like, we're at the point where this is one generation away from somebody making a thing. They did make ones that looked like microwaves and consumer devices, but they were so unreliable and crappy. It was just a joke. They just said, we'll put a nice case around it and it'll be great. And it's like, no, it wasn't. But we're at the point where you could start to make these things much more easier. Like I was talking about, like, when this doesn't sound horrible. I think when I'll phrase it differently. When a large number of people on TikTok who like crafty stuff really discover these things, people are going to go nuts. It's going to become a thing of, look, I made this jewelry. I made this. Look what I could make.
All right. So what's the website for heroin.com?
It is it's Bamboo Lab, spelled with a U. Bamboo Lab, B-A-M-B-U Lab.
Just .com.
Yeah.
All right. So here this is the A1.
They have the A1 mini, which is cheaper, effectively the same thing. It's just the build plate is much smaller. And I think that you'll probably quickly run into, oh, I wish I had, it's not worth it to jump from the A1 to anything else, because to get to the next level printer, you're, you know, going up a bigger price jump. And I think the A1, in my opinion, for the money, is like the best printer on the market.
Okay, so what does it say? It says,
yeah, $489. That's it. That's it. Dude, just lean back, close your eyes, let it wash over you.
Wait, we're shipped to let USA.
It wash over you.
All right, hold on. We'll put a pin in that.
Right. Oh no.
Hey,
did
you guys get that article I sent you? Shouts out to NASA.
Oh my gosh. So for those of you just tuning in,
should not laugh.
We've been talking about the way NASA historically would pay for things was, and large parts of the government was, they would say, we need a thing. They'd come up with a spec, and then a builder would say, you know, take bids for people to go build it. And then it would go over cost more. Then NASA would keep paying more money. You know, the SLS spacecraft system, SLS system, was an example of something that was originally pitched to us because it would be cheap, because we're talking about the SLS, right? That whole launch system, because, oh, it's getting you stuff we already know how to do, like the space shuttle and Saturn V and all that, which meant we're going to go to the contractors who already know how to screw us over completely. And so the SLS is like probably the most expensive, not quite maybe next to the ISS, but one of the most expensive space initiatives we've ever done. And everybody knows it's useless. Everybody knows it's obsolete, but they still keep throwing money at it. So Starliner and Crew Dragon, that was NASA saying, hey, let's be smart about this. And what we're going to do is we're going to let people make bids or tell us what they're going to, you know, charge. And then we will say, yes, we'll pay you, but that's all the money you get. It's all the money you're going to get to do this. And any overage comes from you, like any other deal that you make anywhere else on the planet.
Yeah.
So the two main winners on that bid were SpaceX and Boeing. And at the time it was kind of controversial because Boeing got almost twice as much money as SpaceX did. And Boeing, there were arguments for it, whatever, but reality, I think, was Boeing knew how to play the system, and Boeing knew, you know, NASA needed two companies they needed two people to choose, and they figured it will go into the higher one because they'll have to pay for us anyways. When NASA and SpaceX were selected, the wisdom for many people in the old space was, well, Boeing's going to get this first. Boeing's the best.
Yeah.
Because Boeing's been doing this forever with building their spacecraft, et cetera. And my argument was, Boeing is a name. Boeing is a name you put on letterhead. The people that built those systems aren't necessarily there. And one of the things we know that happened at Boeing was they got rid of a lot of their higher, more experienced engineers. They put in a layer of bureaucrats, whatever. Long story short, SpaceX was putting astronauts on the space station several years ago, and they've done like six missions or whatever. Starliner finally was going to have its first launch with crew astronauts to the International Space Station last month or a few weeks ago. And they had to delay the launch originally because there was a problem with helium tanks leaking. And so they delayed the launch and finally did the launch, did the orbital insertion while trying to dock. Something like 5 thrusters malfunctioned, but they finally got it to dock with the International Space Station. And the astronauts were due to come back like now, but they haven't. But NASA and Boeing assure us that they are not stranded there, that everything is fine.
The two of them are just, they safely are attached, but not able to enter the International Space Station. wonderful news, they were provisioned for what was it, 45 days? I mean, the mission was planned
they're in the space station. You mean they can't leave it?
Oh, wait. Oh, they are in there. Okay. I thought from me reading this, it sounded like that they were just in the capsule and weren't able to get in.
Oh, God, no. I don't think they'd be there. No, that would be.
Yeah, okay. But it says here, we talked about a 45-day limit limited by the crew module batteries on Starliner because, of course, they got to get home somehow. They've been looking at stuff, and so they realized that maybe they could double it for 90 days. Who wants to go a 3-hour tour? A 3-hour tour. So they're stuck in space on a ship that wasn't
made quite right. That's scary, dude.
Yeah. So they say progress has been made. The helium leaks have stabilized, and all but one of the errant thrusters is ready for use to come back to Earth. Starliner has 28 thrusters. 5 were misbehaving. Those 5, only one will be taken offline. I don't know. I know that, you know, when your plan was to come back and you haven't come back yet, and the reason you haven't come back yet is because you have uncertainty about your vehicle. That's not good. You know, they say, oh, it's rated to stay as long as 210 days in orbit. Like, yeah. And it was rated to have, you know, working thrusters in helium tanks too. So,
look, well, our position is, was, and always has been unambiguous. We want maximum competition. We want everybody to win. And we take no delight in this frustrating position. But who, boy, is it fascinating to see mid 20th century mentalities try to survive into the mid 21st century.
Well, yeah, and it's that, you know, one of our, you know, our frustrating things is these arguments from authority, which can be completely misplaced. And they, I saw that repeatedly. It was, well, Boeing is not a person. Boeing is a brand name. Anybody can buy that brand name and come into that factory and do dumb things, which Boeing did with aviation. We found, you know, like what literally trying to make a deal with the government to deal with criminal charges for what they did, criminal charges for what part of what that management structure did. And it's frustrating because I believe that Boeing has great engineers and people like that, but I think they have this middle management level there, which is just destroyed one of the most biggest. Boeing used to be one of the most valuable American brands that America made in the world. Everybody wanted Boeing aircraft. Boeing was known for these high capabilities. And now you just watch Boeing has become a joke.
By the way, this is marketing, Brian, bubbling up. When you say brand is really just reputation, what you're known for. You know, it's like, you know, Rolex watches are known for, you know, being high quality timekeeping devices and so on. And that can erode over time. And so when people talk about brands going to crap, brands can also come back. You know, we saw various attempts of that in the past.
Yeah, but the difference is when your brand is safety and your one thing you're supposed to sell is safety, and you let that erode, it's one thing to say, we're going to do an experimental slate of movies. Okay, who cares? You know, you know, Star Wars getting run into the ground, Marvel Comics getting run into the ground. All right, that's fine. Airplane business, like, that's just not good.
Well, yes.
I mean, also that is an industry without a ton of players, and you know, I think that there's, it's hard to compare apples to apples when it comes to brand and reputation, but I do remember very, very vividly during the Enron scandal, there was one friend of mine by the name of Andrew Main that when their accounting firm came out and admitted that they had aided and abetted some of the fraud, my friend Andrew said, well, they're done. They're done forever. Like that's accounting that's it. Firm. You can't, you cannot be an accounting firm that aids and abets fraud. And throughout all of the tough, we're going to stick it out talk, they were done.
Well, I had a friend that said, well, because it was only one tiny division that Arthur Anderson that did that. And then I had a friend whose father had an accounting firm and says, you know, we did the math because he had a friend, his brother worked there. We did, you know, they could survive with one third of their clients. I go, dude, they lose 10% of their clients. They're dead. He's like, no, they're not. I go, yeah. Once 10% go, everybody else goes. He goes, oh, I don't know about that. And then it's like you, they have one thing to sell and they ruined that.
I could have sworn that Arthur Anderson just changed their name to Accenture and that they're still the same folks. But maybe I'm missing. I remember having, this is before I had met you guys, but I remember having the same kind of thoughts like, oh, well, we'll see how long they stick around. And then they said, congratulations, we're now this other company.
Well, they sold off assets into parts of it became other stuff.
Got it.
Like, right. And so like, yeah, Accenture. That is that. But Accenture's now they do a big part of what they do is really is placing employees into companies and stuff. So I don't think Accenture really does taxes or anything like that.
Got it. So they got out of the parts that relied on their reputation at the time.
Yeah. And again, like Arthur Anderson, by and large, was a great company, you know, was a great company. And they had one small division that, and you could arguably say it could have happened at any company because it is hard to know that what they're doing there, but that is, yeah, but that was, you know, because I'd say like, I was defending, like, I get it, but they're not going to survive. You know, it's, we're not in a world where people are going to weigh that and go, well, that's like, and I had a friend, you know, who, you know, had a firm with them and it was like, he said, yeah, it's the same decision. Like we have to leave them now because we can't tell our clients, we use Arthur Anderson because you don't get the benefit of them going, oh, I understand what you're saying. Logically speaking, it was one tiny division.
So we got an email and I hope I'm not going to say his name, but this is, you know, we're getting into picks here and he had such delightfully, this is one of the first emails I read after I emerged from my COVID coma and it just made me laugh out loud. I hope he doesn't mind me using his colorful language because I truly take to heart. Basically, what he wants to say is he loves the show. He loves it so much that he sometimes is in a place where he can't stop it as we go from talking picks to accidentally drifting into spoilers. But his language was amazing. He goes, I often listen to your show while I'm showering between shifts. I'm unable to stop it mid-spoil as I'm soaping wet in sudsea. Oh, I took 22-hour days kind of back to work and I'm in need of a special kind of show that brings me joy. It really bums me out that having tiny spoilers on the black cloud of misery complaints from Mr. Writer, Mr. Reporter, and Captain Spoils.
Yeah, I was going to say, Brian.
I wonder
Brian,
who's who.
Yeah, Brian, you had a mouse in your pocket when you're talking about we are spoiling things?
He says, I love you three, and yet it grinds my gears every show to be ripped apart. However, I love the recommended section. So he says, do with that what you will. But
I hope you, dear listener, understand our daily lives even better. Because, by the way, imagine you're driving and Brian just says, have you seen a movie that came out 2 hours ago? Because he lives across the street from a movie theater. And then you say, no, I haven't seen it yet. And then he says, yeah, not a spoiler, but the entire third act. And
you would enjoy, this is a little bit saucy. He says, picks is a bit like being given a nice BJ and then having the recipient fart a stale fart directly into the eye of the gifter. no more stale farts. You are heard. dear listener. You are heard.
Yeah.
You are heard. So you guys want to know how the bear ends?
I have a feeling we're going to find out.
No,
my dad would tell my brother, oh, I saw this thing. We'd like, dad, stop. Well, just the thing. And my dad would just have to tell. And he was describing some show that I was kind of curious about, but there was this big twist ending. He goes, yeah, when that happened, I'm like, dad, like, I don't get the experience now of watching this thing because now I have to look for the thing he just said. Oh, well, you know, and like, I love my father. I love my father very much. But my brother and I would go, dad, we have money. We can buy movie theater tickets. You don't have to tell us the plot. We can afford to see this.
One more time, dear reader, thank you for your thoughtful email. I would receive 1,000 times more of these if I had the ability. Like
my pick is X-Men 97. We started watching it last night. We got 3 episodes in, and
so good.
Boy, I don't know. It feels good when a superhero show just has a fun time with superheroes. It's one of those things where it's like, all right, look, they're doing a half hour X-Men story. So how about in every, I almost wonder whether or not this was like a rule in the writer's room. Every scene, somebody uses their powers. Sometimes it's silly. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's very serious. Sometimes it's an action scene. But every scene, you're reminded of why the X-Men are the X-Men. The 3 episodes we watched, super fun. It felt good and it felt X-Men-y. And I'm looking forward to getting to the end.
I let my subscription to Disney Plus lapse, but I got into well into the story, and it uses what I like, kind of like the Top Gun Maverick theory, which is imagine your source material, which people love, was way better than it was.
Yes. Yes.
And write to that. And they do. God, it is so good. It's like, there's no, I don't believe in superhero fatigue. I believe in bad storytelling fatigue. And what happens, fatigue comes in, you get a bunch of people, excited writers who come in first to go write a thing, who want to tell stories and to expand the boundaries of it. Then they bring in some other writers and there's still some of that creative, let's push the boundaries. Then people think the thing they're writing is the genre. You're like, oh, this is a Star Wars movie, is you got to go blow up a big planet that's trying to destroy everything else. Somebody learns a force. Somebody does this, whatever. When you went from Star Wars to Empire, complete tonal shift. Batman Begins to Dark Knight, complete tonal shift, whatever. The problem we get into so much stuff is they just think that they get so, everything becomes a repeat, everything else, and it becomes bad and they don't push it. And I love this. I was very happy.
Yeah. And by the way, for the folks who are like, oh, you know, it's either like it has to be not political or it has to be political, blah, blah, blah. This is like very political. Like there are, you know, lines out of these characters that very much harken back to the idea that Professor X is patterned on Martin Luther King and Magneto is,
Malcolm X.
Malcolm X, yeah, Professor X is Martin Luther King and Malcolm X is Magneto. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of research on 1968, which very much revolves around a lot of the fruits of the divisions between the civil rights movement. And there are lines that are out of Magneto's mouth that are like Stokely Carmichael lines and a Malcolm X line that are accelerationist, but they've put the characters in interesting positions. They have them elucidating them. You're in an animated series, so you can do things that you wouldn't be able to do in a live action that are cool, that show off the powers and stuff like that. But it's just rad. There's just rad, cool stuff happening. The stories are good. And I think, Andrew, you're very much right. It is written for adults who liked a children's show and remember the children's show as more interesting and complex than it probably was at the time. But that's exactly what you want. I'm a big, big, big fan. Thumbs up.
Did you guys read the news that,
can I get, wait, let me get one more follow-up.
Sure.
So X-Men 97, right before its launch though, the showrunner, the guy, the head writer, creator, Bo DiMaio got fired. We don't know why. They fired, and you're like, man, this is the greatest thing you've had. And who knows what's going
there's,
on there?
Yeah, there's rumors. He had an OnlyFans that apparently he didn't get along with some of the brass or some of his writers and everything. Here's my thing. All right, I'm just gonna come back to it. If the art's good, let him cook. I'm sorry. You want to, like, we're here now, but the art's good. Just let the man. You know, I don't know. Air his dirty laundry in public if you need to. Let him suffer the repercussions. But oh God, it's so good. It's just every little thing. And he, like, there's a scene in which a character needs to exit a place quickly. They have telepathic powers, and they just throw the car keys into somebody's hands. Because that's the cool thing about being the X-Men, is that when these situations happen, you just demonstrate, oh, it's really cool. Wolverine is cool. Like, and it's cool looking at a take on Wolverine where he's just the brooding Wolverine and not the kind of hero that every Wolverine character had to become post Hugh Jackman, where it's like, oh, well, let's base everything around it. It's really cool to see him be a 1A character. I don't know. Thumbs up all around.
Yeah. And I just want Brian to start. It's an example of where somebody's politics and worldview may be completely alien or something different to me, but if their passion, their storytelling is there, I'm all aboard.
Let's go.
So, X-Men 97, here's my conspiracy theory was the bridge that proved that you could just set things in different timescapes, which is why I was so thrilled when the news came out this week that it is not a spoiler, officially announced that the Fantastic Four movie is going to be set in 1960s.
The 1960s,
It'll be an alternate, New York, maybe not the New York we know, but, you know, whatever. Which just tickles between the success of X-Men 97 and the fact that maybe they'll do Fantastic Four right. What if we got just a new MCU that was entirely Silver Age, first generation iterations of all of our favorite characters at that time?
Well, you know, then in the Multiverse of Madness, when Professor X makes his appearance,
yeah,
the theme music was
and I believe the wheelchair he was in was also matching that theme, right?
Yeah. So certainly I don't want to get too many hopes up that there's any kind of real plan anywhere going on, because I haven't seen the good stuff that happens is like what if season one was great, and then like typical Disney, they don't pay their head writers much, whatever. Somebody, you get a really talented person who goes and does it. I hadn't seen the second season yet, because I even look at the titles. I go, I don't care. It doesn't really sound interesting to me, whatever. They have a habit of sometimes getting really exceptionally talented people and getting them to do like a short run or some other, and then replacing them or bringing in just staff or whatever. Or I don't know what happens. And then it just kind of goes, meh, meh. So,
My pick is something I don't think any of you have heard of. It's a little show on FX called Shogun. It's quite good. I described it. I was trying to show my appreciation to Justin Robert Young, and I think of it as, it's like Game of Thrones on hard mode, because you also, like, very little of it is in English, and so much of it is completely, excellently non-verbally communicated in, like, was that a wry smile or you know, was that a double glance, or and yet by the end of it, you know, it's one of those stories that you just jump in with episode one, you're like, I have no idea what's happening, which you're not supposed to, because it's all seen through the eyes of, you know, the Westerner who also has no idea what's going on. But then over time, the story resolves itself, and oh boy, is it good and highly produced. Also, executive producer Justin Marks, and I think it's Rachel Kondo, his significant other. Justin Marks did Counterpart, which was a sci-fi take on the Berlin Wall. And I'm just so pleased that it's so good. I can't wait to watch it again. I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And you know, my couple minor crits, you know, my one crit is that once you notice something, it's hard not to notice them. And one of the things that I noticed, and I think I made the comment on Twitter, is like with Shogun, is productions are often limited by budget and whatnot. And I think they did a beautiful job of, you know, using, you know, British Columbia locations for that. Looked great. Look this. The villages look great. Look this. And the difference, though, is when I can tell the difference between a movie and a TV show is movies will often add details that you don't think about. There are no dogs, like almost like no dogs anywhere in this. And Japan, this was like near the reign of an emperor who loved dogs, or dogs all over Japan. Like there would have been lots of dogs. And when you watch, next time you watch any kind of medieval or any kind of period piece or whatever, and there's just no dogs there, you know, oh, this is... they did a good job. But, and again, it's like, they're like, it's, you know, production wise, I get it. I get why, but it was that little detail. I'm like, this is what's kind of missing here.
Also keep in mind, I think even a decade later, I'm suffering from the low budget PTSD of Marco Polo, which kind of had a similar vibe to it in that a Westerner has to make inroads with a Eastern trading power. And, you know, Genghis Khan, played by Benny Wong, was incredible. Meanwhile, there were shots where I went back. I was like, did I just see that? And I paused it and you could see a Canon DSLR kind of half in the frame that nobody noticed to remove. And then every time a battle happened, they just cut to a narration over a drawing of what the battle looked like. And like, just to see how rich this iteration of a similar type of tale was.
It was especially so in the place that always looks like the same place. Like British Columbia has been shot in so much that it kind of became the aesthetic for a boring sci-fi original that at some point, like, we're on a planet. It looks like Vancouver and we're going to run through it and shoot CGI space lasers at each other. This taking those same forests and making them look like Japan to the point where I was like, damn, was this shot somewhere else? It's like, no, BC. And it's like, well, congratulations. You are now an amazing set dresser that you made this place that I've seen a million times look different.
My frustration with Marco Polo, and this happened to me too with watching Rings of Power. What I love about Game of Thrones, first several seasons, is that every room, every place they are, like I'm not a purist when it comes to motivated lighting. Like when I work with my wife on her films and stuff, like I'm like, we can have a light here. And I get into argue with the DP, like, where's the light coming from? I'm like, there's a mirror over there. It's fine. Don't worry. We can have this light here because that'll make sense. Cause I watch, like, I think Spielberg does great lighting. And sometimes if you break down, like, wait, where's that light coming from? Sometimes it's not so clear. But when you do period pieces, it's really, really important to have an understanding of where this is, because that's what can break your reality. For me, Marco Polo, I remember, like, they go into the harem, you know, whatever tent, and it's like Studio 54 lighting coming from all these directions. And I said, this destroys it for me, because you made it look modern, so it's no longer exotic. And I get, you know, Game of Thrones uses tons of light. But you look at every set and you see the tension they put into, go, okay, we're in the middle of this castle. Where's the light going to come from? Oh, we're going to have these skylights up here, whatever. We know light's going to come through. And we're at nighttime. The table's going to have a ton of candles on it or whatever. We're going to have big, huge fireplaces so we can glow. They really spend a lot of time doing that. And that's why when I watch Game of Thrones, the good ones, I felt like I was in that world. But when I watch a period piece that uses really bad lighting and it feels like a modern contemporary show, it breaks it. And that was, you know, one of the many problems with Marco Polo. And Rings of Power was the same thing. You're in the dwarf mines of Moria in the middle, and it's like they're in a living room. You know, they're like this dwarf living room, and it's just lit. Everything's perfectly lit, all of this sort of stuff. And I'm like, this is like horrible production design, absolutely horrible. And it's like one of the most expensive TV shows ever. And is it thinking like, well, people won't care? Like, your mind doesn't feel like you're there. Your mind feels like I'm in a contemporary living room by a guy that loves D&D, not.
But Maine, when you watch Rings of Power, you know where that money went, in the bank accounts of people who did a bad job.
That's true. That is true. I rewatched a movie that I watched some film theory thing where somebody had a theory on this. I said, I'm going to go watch it. And their theory was completely wrong. But nonetheless, I went to rewatch The Prestige. And the spoilers for anybody taking a shower right now. The Prestige is one of my favorite Christopher Nolan films because of just the reveal. I did not see the reveal coming. And then you watch it again and you feel stupid because they literally rub your face in the reveal of like Michael Caine explains to you, he's using a double. He tells you this and you're like, no, what's going on really? And then you're like, yeah, you notice Christian Bale and all these other scenes too. You're like, it's just, I love it because it was so in your face. But the theory somebody had said, and I don't agree with this, they said that that the character we had, Nikola Tesla and his assistant Addie, I forget his name, Ari or whatever his assistant's name, their theory was that the assistant was actually Tesla. And that Bowie was like an actor hired to play the part, whatever. I watch a video and they make a couple like, look in here, look at where Christian Bale's character's looking, and it would suggest to that. And the idea that one person's this, whatever. And then I go watch it. I'm like, nah, it doesn't really. There's a lot of other scenes that go, no, like this doesn't make any sense, for that.
I wouldn't put it past them to try that idea on for size and then change their minds and cut it out in the final edit or whatever.
I would say, look, Christopher Nolan is somebody that is very, very well known for his intricate plots and twists, right? But he is more prone to try to do a thing that is too complicated, see Interstellar or Tenet, than he is to do something that is too subtle, in my opinion. And that it makes a lot of sense that a guy like Christopher Nolan would be like, no, I want to cast David Bowie as Tesla, and I want to have him be this kind of character in this story, than it does for him to layer in another thing on top of it.
Well, because there are scenes where like the introduction to Tesla is he's walking through the electrical fields and toward you. And it's like, okay, that's just an actor hired to play the part of Tesla. Like they'd say like, oh, he refused to appear on stage here. I'm like, yeah, but like, Tesla had a thick accent and these other things. It was like, there weren't any clues there were, you could infer, but you would have to say, then what about this? What about this? And so,
yeah,
to me, I mean, I like theories though. I'm like, I'm going to stop. But anyway, I really enjoyed The Prestige. It's such a,
it holds up, man. Every 5 years I go back and rewatch it and I'm like, still great.
I also think it's one of those movies for Nolan's filmography that's like a real legend builder. Because it's such a heater of a movie. It's got such a good cast. It's just the fact that it came around when he was doing these other gigantic movies that it is kind of like smaller in stature, but like the greats, like Spielberg or like Kubrick or like Hitchcock, it is still often cited as, oh, that might be his best. Like it might not have been his biggest, but if you look at it scene for scene, quality for quality, like moments, it's going to be, it reminds me of like, Jackie Brown. Jackie Brown might be my favorite Quentin Tarantino movie. It's not his most famous, but it still might be the best example of him doing what he does. It is such a resume builder, The Prestige. I love it.
Yeah. So, and maybe there could be more to it, though. It could have been a draft or whatever, but I would think that there weren't enough things to make me think that Bowie should not have been Tesla. And he gets, like, the really good speeches and the other stuff. And again, Ali is always there, so who knows. But yeah, that's my pick. It's been weird.